You arrive for inpatient rounds, and a new patient catches your interest. Miss Harrison is a 33-year-old woman admitted last night with chest pain on inhalation, pulsus paradoxus, and an echocardiogram confirming a pericardial effusion. She reports a photosensitive rash on her cheeks and joint pains in her hands. Her diagnostic tests reveal a normal white blood cell count, but anemia and thrombocytopenia. And although she has a normal serum electrolyte panel and normal serum creatinine, she has microscopic hematuria and proteinuria. As you consider her multiple symptoms and findings, you wonder, what underlying pathophysiology could create such disparate symptoms and findings? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing immunology from our bricks to your ears. Let's get started. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Define systemic lupus erythematosus, or lupus, and describe its major clinical manifestations. 2. Describe the pathogenesis of lupus. 3. Describe the spectrum of autoantibodies in lupus, including which are most diagnostic. And 4. Describe the typical clinical course of lupus and its treatment options. Part 1. What is systemic lupus erythematosus? Lupus is a systemic autoimmune disease that causes the body's immune system to attack its own tissues and organs. It can do so through a variety of different autoantibodies, which attack widely expressed antigens, for example, like double-stranded DNA. And so it can lead to various combinations of multi-organ system symptoms and presentations. The severity of the symptoms seen in lupus range from mild to severe, and additionally, symptoms may wax and wane within a single patient, making the clinical course unpredictable. Symptoms typically first present in young adults in their 20s and 30s, but may occur in school-aged children up through any age group. Lupus affects women more often than men, and the prevalence of lupus is lower in white patients compared to other races. Here's a question for you. Do patients with lupus typically present with one predominating symptom or multiple manifestations of their disease? Lupus can cause symptoms in almost every organ, and patients with lupus, by definition, have multiple manifestations of disease. The key to diagnosis is recognizing that these symptoms could be related to lupus, and then ordering the appropriate tests to confirm just that. Our patient, Ms. Harrison, presents with a potentially classical presentation of lupus, a young woman with multiple organ system involvement including the skin, joints, bone marrow, kidney, and serosa, the pericardium in this case. However, it's important to note that it would be rare for any two lupus patients to present or experience the exact same combination of symptoms. Part 2. What are the major clinical manifestations of lupus? It can be helpful to group the clinical manifestations of lupus by body system. Such groupings can assist with classification criteria for lupus. The typical groupings include constitutional symptoms, mucocutaneous, musculoskeletal, serosal, including pleural, pericardial, and/or peritoneal, hematologic, renal, neuropsychiatric, and immunologic findings. Now let's dig in a little deeper to each of these groupings. One of the most common set of symptoms that lupus patients experience are constitutional symptoms. The large majority of patients experience fatigue at some point during the course of their illness. Other constitutional symptoms may include fever, decreased appetite, and weight loss. While common in lupus, these symptoms are naturally not specific to lupus either, so next, I'd like to discuss some mucocutaneous clinical presentations, and some of these are quite specific to lupus. One of the most well-known of these manifestations is the malor or butterfly rash. This rash presents as macular erythema across the cheeks and bridge of the nose, but sparing the nasolabial folds. It is often photosensitive and increases after sun exposure, much like the rash of our patient, Ms. Harrison. Other mucocutaneous manifestations may include painless oral ulcers, non-scarring alopecia, fingernail abnormalities such as pitting or ankylosis, and what is termed a discoid rash. The discoid rash of lupus can be described as disc-shaped, non-tender lesions that are centrally hypopigmented and peripherally hyperpigmented. They often appear on the scalp or face and lead to permanent scarring, including alopecia. The discoid rash may alternatively be present on the fingertips and lead to peeling and blistering of the skin just below the nail. This rash is also often photosensitive in lupus patients. An additional cutaneous symptom many lupus patients experience is Raynaud's phenomena. This is a vascular condition and a form of cutaneous vasculitis, which presents as pallor or cyanosis of the fingers or toes due to vasoconstriction and vascular spasming. Raynaud's phenomenon is often very uncomfortable for patients. Like the constitutional symptoms, it's not specific to lupus, yet it's reasonably common in lupus patients. Let's take a brief break with a question now. Can you name two of the common mucocutaneous presentations of lupus? Mucocutaneous presentations of lupus may include a malar or butterfly rash, a discoid rash, oral ulcers, alopecia, and changes to the fingernails. The rashes of lupus may also be photosensitive. Raynaud's phenomenon is another common clinical and cutaneous presentation in lupus patients. Next, let's discuss some of the musculoskeletal symptoms that lupus patients may present with. Arthritis and arthralgias are common manifestations of lupus. They may be migratory, but arthritis is typically non-erosive in lupus. Patients may present with pain disproportionate to the amount of swelling and erythema. It may affect many different joints, but most commonly it presents in the fingers, wrists, and knees. Because many autoimmune diseases share similar and overlapping characteristics, rheumatoid arthritis is often on the list of potential diagnoses when a patient is newly presenting with lupus. In contrast to lupus, the arthritis in rheumatoid arthritis is typically non-migratory and typically erosive and deforming. Okay, so the next body system we'll be discussing relates to what rheumatologists categorize as serosal disease. Serosal disease includes inflammation of the pericardium, pleura, and/or peritoneum. Our patient, Ms. Harrison, is presenting with pericarditis, inflammation of the membrane surrounding the heart. This is the most common cardiac manifestation of lupus, and it may lead to a pericardial effusion, which is a fluid collection in the pericardial space that may impact cardiac output. Inflammation of the lining of the lungs, known as pleuritis, is the most common pulmonary manifestation of lupus. Patients with pleuritis complain of chest pain that is worse when they cough, laugh, sneeze, or inhale deeply. This pain may cause patients to take shallow breaths, predisposing them to pneumonia. The pleuritis and inflammatory response may also lead to pleural effusions. In addition to pericarditis, lupus may also have direct effects on the cardiac parenchyma distinct from the serosal features, affecting the heart valves, myocardium, and conduction system. Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis is a non-infectious form of endocarditis that is specific to lupus. In this form of endocarditis, wart-like clusters of immune cells are present on both sides of the valve leaflet, in contrast to other types of endocarditis in which bacteria seed the heart and cause vegetations on only one side of the valve leaflet. The vegetations may impair the ability of the valve to open and close properly and may ultimately produce valvular insufficiency and heart failure. Moving along to the next body system, lupus may also present with a variety of hematologic findings. These include a reduction in the number of circulating blood cells in any of, or multiple of, the cell lines, leading to, quote-unquote, penias. These disorders include leukopenia, or a low white blood cell count, lymphopenia, which is a low lymphocyte count, thrombocytopenia, a low platelet count, and anemia, low red blood cell count. The mechanisms by which lupus causes these penias are varied and range from bone marrow suppression to antibody-mediated autoimmune destruction. Additionally, some patients may develop a hypercoagulable state. This occurs when antiphospholipid antibodies target mechanisms involved in platelet aggregation and clotting and predispose patients to thrombotic events, including deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, thrombotic or embolic strokes, and myocardial infarction. Antiphospholipid antibodies may also impact pregnancy through thrombotic events in the placenta, leading to spontaneous miscarriage or premature delivery. Another organ system that may be affected by lupus is the kidney. Lupus may present with inflammation of the kidneys called lupus nephritis. Lupus nephritis is a major cause of morbidity and mortality for lupus patients. It results from circulating autoantibodies that have formed into immune complexes, and they then deposit in the glomerulus of the kidney, causing inflammation, destruction, and scarring. This may present clinically as blood and protein in the urine, activation of renin with resulting hypertension, and if severe, it may impair glomerular filtration and cause acute kidney injury. Lupus nephritis has divided up into 6 pathologic classifications, and diffuse proliferative lupus nephritis, or class 4 lupus nephritis, is one of the most important to keep in mind. Class 4 lupus nephritis is a sign of severe proliferative disease and immunologic injury, yet it's treatable. On the other hand, if it's left untreated or if it's not responsive to therapy, it's associated with a very poor prognosis. Moving on, neuropsychiatric symptoms are less common but also may be present in patients with lupus. Symptoms include seizures, psychosis, and delirium, and may be a sign of lupus cerebritis, which is a very serious manifestation often referred to as a CNS vasculitis, and it is associated with a very high morbidity and mortality. The last remaining body system to discuss is the immunologic manifestations of lupus. However, I'd like to save those for our diagnostic testing discussion later in the episode. Instead, let's take a break with a question. We're calling our patient, Ms. Harrison. Can you name 4 of her clinical findings that could suggest she has a new diagnosis of lupus? Ms. Harrison was admitted for treatment of pericarditis with a pericardial effusion. This could be a manifestation of lupus. So could her symptoms of a photosensitive rash and joint pain, as well as her findings of anemia, thrombocytopenia, microscopic hematuria, and proteinuria. Now that we've revisited her case, it's really starting to sound like she could have lupus, right? Part 3. What causes systemic lupus erythematosus? Patients with hereditary or acquired conditions that may pose risk for immunologic dysregulation may be more susceptible for developing lupus. A combination of hereditary and environmental factors may result in an immunologic event in which an antibody is generated against a self-antigen, generally nuclear antigens. In lupus patients, this autoantibody is not able to be cleared away by normal immune regulatory mechanisms, and this leads to the clinical manifestations of lupus. So, lupus then presents with a collection of manifestations, and it may happen from a variety of different autoantibodies. And the different autoantibodies are what lead to the variable combination of manifestations in each individual lupus patient. In summary, then, first, a genetic susceptibility, for example, disorders of the complement system, combined with an external insult, for example, tobacco and ultraviolet light, or an infectious illness. And this leads to the development of autoantibodies targeted against self-antigens, generally nuclear antigens like double-stranded DNA, or RNA, or RNA-associated proteins. This results in the formation of antigen-antibody immune complexes, and these complexes may activate toll-like receptors, stimulating the innate immune system, further increasing autoantibody production, and ultimately the release of cytokines, causing target tissue inflammation, injury, and the clinical manifestations of lupus. Certain drugs may also cause the body to develop immune dysregulation and autoantibodies, and this supports this mechanism, because we can see these drugs leading to a drug-induced lupus condition. this can present with a similarly varied combination of multi-organ system effects. In these cases, though, the manifestations will often resolve when the offending drug is discontinued. A mnemonic, SHIP, with two P's, may be used to help recall the drugs that can cause a lupus-like syndrome. The SHIP drugs include sulfonamides, hydralazine, isoniazid, procainamide, and phenytoin. Part 4. How is systemic lupus erythematosus diagnosed? Lupus is often challenging to diagnose, recalling that it can present with a variety of skin, musculoskeletal, serosal, hematologic, renal, and neurologic effects, and many are not particularly specific to lupus on an individual basis. Rather, it's the combination of manifestations and the remitting and relapsing nature that may lead to the diagnosis. Unfortunately, as lupus often presents insidiously, this challenge may delay the diagnosis until the above pattern becomes more evident. Once lupus is considered, the hallmark testing to confirm the diagnosis is to screen for the immunologic manifestations of lupus. This includes testing for the presence of anti-nuclear antibodies, or ANAs, and identifying the specific autoantibodies present in the patient's serum. For example, anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies. Testing may also identify a nonspecific increase of inflammatory markers in the blood, such as erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or ESR, and C-reactive protein, or CRP. These latter tests, as well as the anti-nuclear antibody tests, are very sensitive, but not specific for lupus. Therefore, if the tests are completely normal, there is a very low chance that the patient has lupus. Conversely, a positive ANA, or elevated inflammatory marker, can occur in patients who do not have autoimmune disease, and so a positive test alone would not confirm the diagnosis. Let's take a break for a quick question now. If our patient, Ms. Harrison, had a negative anti-nuclear antibody test, what would that indicate? A negative anti-nuclear antibody test would make lupus a much less likely diagnosis because it is a highly sensitive screening test. Now, let's take a closer look at the specific types of anti-nuclear antibodies we can test for. These tests tend to be more specific and are useful to provide strong diagnostic confirmation of lupus in a patient with clinical manifestations as well as an ANA result that is suggesting a lupus diagnosis. Some of these specific antibodies correlate strongly with specific clinical manifestations. Likewise, some are present specifically in lupus, whereas others may be present in other autoimmune diseases as well. For example, autoantibodies against double-stranded DNA are strongly associated with lupus nephritis, and they are also very specific for the lupus diagnosis. Autoantibodies against the Smith antigen of small ribonuclear protein particles is also very specific for lupus. On the other hand, autoantibodies against the U1 ribonucleoprotein may also be found in other autoimmune diseases, like mixed connective tissue disease, and so are less specific for lupus. Of note, autoantibodies against the Rho and La nucleoproteins are well known for causing neonatal lupus, which occurs when a mother expresses these autoantibodies and they travel across the placenta to the fetus. An important manifestation of neonatal lupus is congenital heart block. Anti-Rho and anti-La antibodies are also not specific for lupus, as they may be present in other autoimmune conditions such as Sjögren's syndrome and primary biliary cirrhosis. Question break. Given our patient, Ms. Harrison, and her clinical manifestations, what autoantibody tests would you predict she might be positive for? If Ms. Harrison has lupus, we'd expect her to test positive for ANA. Given her symptoms of hematuria and proteinuria, anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies seem likely too, as anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies are strongly associated with lupus nephritis. Okay, so given that lupus is a condition that can wax and wane with multiple relapses, it is helpful to screen for markers then so providers can identify and recognize relapses before extensive damage and organ injury develops. Recall that relapses are associated with immune complex formation. These can be screened for by monitoring the complement system, which is activated by immune complexes. Lupus relapses are characterized by low levels of complement 3 and complement 4 proteins in the blood. So when screening for disease flares, we look for low levels of these complement proteins, which indicates that the system has been activated and the proteins have been used up from consumption. Part 5. How is systemic lupus erythematosus treated? The goal of treatment in lupus is disease remission, because unfortunately there is currently no cure. Treatment centers on decreasing inflammation and controlling relapses, as well as maintaining remission and preventing relapses. Lupus remission can typically be achieved with immunosuppressant and immunomodulating medications. Fortunately, most cases will respond to treatment, though this does require strong medications with quite a number of side effects. These side effects leave patients at increased susceptibility to common viral and bacterial infections, as well as some less common or opportunistic infections. It is important to note that there are also some more challenging or refractory cases, and even less commonly, there are cases that progress to death. Given the incidence of cardiovascular, hematologic, and renal manifestations, healthy lifestyle habits are an important aspect of treatment, such as refraining from cigarette smoke. An additional precaution for lupus patients is to limit sun exposure and use sunscreens to minimize impacts from the sun's ultraviolet light. Glucocorticoids are commonly used in disease flare-ups. In more severe cases with organ system disease such as class 3 or class 4 nephritis or lupus cerebritis, additional agents including cyclophosphamide, mycophenolate, or others may be used. To maintain remission and control mucocutaneous and musculoskeletal manifestations, disease-modifying drugs such as the anti-malarial medication hydroxychloroquine are well proven. Let's stop here for one last question. If Ms. Harrison is confirmed to have lupus, what medication might you begin to treat her disease? Given her multi-organ system involvement, including pericarditis, anemia, and thrombocytopenia, as well as renal involvement, systemic glucocorticoids would be indicated. Depending on her evaluation, additional immunosuppressive or immunomodulating medications may be needed too. Okay, that's all for systemic lupus erythematosus. Let's see if we've completed our goals for this episode. First, can you define systemic lupus erythematosus and describe its pathogenesis? Lupus is a systemic autoimmune disease that occurs when the body attacks its own tissues and organs through a variety of autoantibodies directed against widely expressed antigens, for example, double-stranded DNA. A combination of genetic susceptibility with an external insult leads to autoantibody formation, resulting in circulating antigen-antibody immune complexes. These deposit in target tissue, causing inflammation, injury, and the clinical manifestations of lupus. Next, can you describe at least 5 of the most common organ systems affected by lupus? By attacking widely expressed antigens, lupus leads to various combinations of multi-organ system symptoms and presentations. The clinical symptoms and findings of lupus may be grouped into many body systems, and it may present as any combination of constitutional symptoms, mucocutaneous, musculoskeletal, serosal, hematologic, renal, neuropsychiatric, and/or immunologic findings. And can you describe which autoantibodies are the most sensitive or specific for lupus? The hallmark of lupus is the presence of anti-nuclear antibodies, which is very sensitive for lupus, but not specific. To increase specificity, identifying the specific autoantibodies present in the patient's serum is helpful. For example, anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies and anti-Smith antibodies are very specific for lupus. Lastly, can you describe the typical clinical course of lupus and its treatment options? Lupus is a chronic condition with periods of relapse and remission. The goal of treatment in lupus is disease remission because, unfortunately, there is currently no cure. Treatment centers on decreasing inflammation and controlling relapses, as well as maintaining remission and preventing relapses. Lupus remission can typically be achieved with immunosuppressant and immunomodulating medications. Most cases respond well to treatment, but there are some very challenging and refractory cases, and even less commonly those that progress to death. Thinking back on your new patient, Ms. Harrison, a 33-year-old woman admitted for pericarditis with effusion and a history of a photosensitive rash, joint pain, anemia, thrombocytopenia, and microscopic hematuria and proteinuria, you consider her multiple symptoms and findings. You wonder, does Ms. Harrison have a unifying diagnosis? If so, what is the underlying pathophysiology that could create such disparate symptoms and findings? You consider whether Ms. Harrison might have systemic lupus erythematosus. By attacking widely expressed antigens, lupus leads to various combinations of multi-organ systems, symptoms, and presentations, as in Ms. Harrison's case. You decide to test for anti-nuclear antibodies and anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, both of which test positive and help to confirm her diagnosis. You discuss with Ms. Harrison the relapsing nature of lupus, and that while treatable, the goal is to first get her current symptoms into remission, and then to maintain her on a regimen that will prevent and control relapses. You discuss the chronic nature of the condition, the importance of monitoring, screening, and living a healthy lifestyle while also limiting direct exposure to the sun. And lastly, you emphasize the interdisciplinary team approach to her condition and how you want to ensure she has access to proper care and support. She acknowledges this is a lot to take in, but seems engaged in her current management and is focused and prepared to participate actively in her care and her health moving forward. And that's all I have for systemic lupus erythematosus. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmlerx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. Stay healthy!